Oh, good morning. I'm Mike Cazalas. I'm editor of the News Herald and a proud Georgia Bulldog fan. We've got Sheriff Tommy Ford here with us this morning. Good morning, Sheriff.
Good morning.
I wanted to... I'm a Noles fan. Okay. When I moved to Florida, they said I could keep Georgia, but I had to pick between FSU and Florida.
Well, I'll get you an FSU shirt.
I have one. I wear it on Fridays. We're here today to talk about a word I can't pronounce, apparently, opioids, and what they're doing in our community. And one of the things I just want to say up front is, if we were in court, you're our elected sheriff, you'd be considered a legal expert on crime, and being a sheriff, the court would accept that. I would be accepted as an expert in nothing. I'm a journalist. I understand that you're not a psychiatrist, you're not a sociologist, you're a sheriff. So some of the things we'll be talking about today will involve opinion based on our experiences, and that's just the kind of discussion we want to have. And if people have questions, we're going to do our best to answer them, but we are not sitting here with a bunch of stats and statistics and that kind of thing. We're sitting here because, from the way y'all have turned it up in law enforcement and the emphasis y'all have put on it, we know that we have, what we're calling an opioid epidemic in our community. We had a series of stories and podcasts and videos this Sunday outlining it, and we wanted to have you here to talk to people, again, just in conversation, about the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to hush up here by asking you, just to get this out of the way, when I hear somebody say we have an opioid epidemic, what does that mean exactly? What is an opioid? What does that encompass drug-wise?
Right. Well, what we're seeing is a local issue, it's a state issue, and it's a national issue. This is going all over the country. But when we talk about opiates, we're talking about anything from opiate to prescription, legally prescribed pain medication, hydrocodone, oxycodone, things of that nature, to heroin, fentanyl, and carfentanil. It kind of goes up the scale from that, where we're seeing the fentanyl and the carfentanil that are, hundreds of times more potent than even heroin. And, all of these have the potential to be abused and even cause death. Certainly can lead to addiction and even death. And that's what I think, that's the epidemic part of this, is the widespread use, addiction, but very critically, the deaths that are occurring from that.
Well, and you speak of deaths, and again, we're not here to throw a bunch of stats out, but while we were setting up, you said that just last night, was it last night or this morning?
Last night we responded to a 25-year-old male who had injected opiates. So we don't know at this point if it's heroin or fentanyl. We've got indication that he was possibly involved in both of those substances, but he was deceased from an overdose from that.
25 years old.
25 years old, yeah.
Okay.
Those are the things that we see all the time, and that's why we're focusing so much resources, and that we're working with you as media partners to try to get information out to hopefully wake people up to this epidemic, so that we can stem the tide of the addiction and the death.
Yeah, it's curious to me. We've had when you were with FDLE, and I came here in the early 80s, I remember when crack cocaine showed up, and that was the epidemic of epidemics. Mm-hmm. They thought, can't get worse than this. Mm-hmm. And then Scoop came along, was killing people, and methamphetamine showed up, and we know what happened with that, and y'all declared war on methamphetamine, mm-hmm. and cleaned up a lot of labs. Mm-hmm. And there was a pain pill epidemic in there, too, where they had pain pill mills down in South Florida, and that was addressed legally. And now it seems like kind of a resurgence of the pain pills, but a lot more people are, with the fentanyl and the heroin, people are dying at a much higher rate now than they were during the pain pill epidemic. How is this one different than that one?
I think that during the pain pill epidemic, this, what we're seeing now has its roots in that. And I think if you look back at the numbers of overdose deaths, were very high at that point. It was due to, you're basically looking at it's the same issue, different sources of supply. At that time, pain clinics were proliferating primarily in South Florida. There were some statistics that, there were some pain management clinics, bogus clinics in South Florida that were responsible for more oxycodone, hydrocodone prescriptions than anywhere else in the United States. So we would have people that would load up in vans and travel down to South Florida, obtain prescriptions and pain pills, and you know would disperse among the state, you know, come back here to Panama City, would use and sell. So we certainly had that issue. The state cracked down, I think it was 2011, 2012, put some new laws in place, put a lot of state and federal resources to attack those down in South Florida and in other areas of the state. I mean, when I was with FDLE at that, and around that time, we arrested several physicians in this area that were over prescribing. So you had a reduction in the source of supply due to those efforts through the pain management clinics, but there's still other avenues for that. And what we see is that, you know, once sources of supply for the illicit heroin and fentanyl are established, you know, they're both opiates. And so if you're addicted to one, you know, you can replace.
That was what I was going to ask, because the last pain pill epidemic, I don't recall seeing the presence of heroin and fentanyl like we do now. And I was wondering if the crackdown on pain pills, you know, drove the addicts to find something else, and heroin became available, you know, free market.
And once sources of supply were established.
And is that kind of, I mean, is that a road that was traveled, of the pain pills were harder to get and heroin became easier to get?
Mm-hmm.
And it made, and is it? Mm-hmm.
And it can switch back and forth, you know, as heroin, you know, say a source of supply of heroin is removed from a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that are addicted are going to do, I'll put it this way, they're going to do whatever it takes to find an opiate.
Okay. Now this is one of those I think. So right. I'll warn you about that, because I've been curious about this. When with pain pills and an addict, and if they're abusing them, they are dealing with a known quantity. They have a 30 milligram pill or a 10 milligram, and it's X percentage of codeine and, you know, aspirin, and they know what they're dealing with when they are going to shoot up or take it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
With heroin and fentanyl, in the especially the synthetic, it's any batch can be stronger than another batch, and you don't always know the strength. And I'm wondering if that's part of the reason we're seeing more sudden deaths from the heroin and the fentanyl is. You don't know what you bought when you buy it.
You are correct. In fact, you don't even know if you've bought heroin or fentanyl. You don't know the strength or the potency. But those deaths were happening with the pain pills that where they would misjudge the amount that their tolerance level. And again, you go back and look at the overdose deaths during that time frame, and I don't have stats with me right now, but we were seeing increased overdose deaths.
Okay.
But you are right. Heroin and fentanyl, you don't know the source, where it was manufactured, the potency of it, or really what it even is. And now you throw the synthetics into the mix, where you really don't know what substance you're using.
Okay, so why, or not why, you know, what are the key things y'all are doing to address this that really need to be ongoing in the community? I know it's important. It's important to us. I know it's important to y'all. It's important to the community that this not wither and die on the, you know, on the vine is just another deal that we want to keep the conversation going.
Yep.
What is the sheriff's office doing with other agencies to, and what kind of help is available for people that need it?
Well, primarily, and I think this sheriff's office has always been very, you know, going back 20, 30 years, have been on the forefront of drug enforcement and placing a priority on drug enforcement. You saw that, you know, with the meth labs with Sheriff McKeithen back in 2003. To, you know, we still don't want to lose the fact that we still have an issue with meth in this community. The pain pill epidemic. We were very aggressive with that and continue to be on the enforcement end. So I think it's important that we put the resources to get this stuff off the street, identify who's selling, who's trafficking, who's bringing it into our community, and working, you know, with the criminal justice system to address and attack it in that manner. But I've really had in my career with FDLE, I worked primarily drug enforcement. I ran a task force over in St. Augustine and was very involved in drug enforcement. And even here when I came in 2003 to FDLE office here. We work very closely with the sheriff's office on the meth lab issue. But I've really, since assuming the role as sheriff and realizing the resources that we have at the Bay County, at the jail, to provide treatment, and the lack of treatment resources in other places, I really have developed a heart for utilizing the resources and the fact that we've got somebody in jail that has an addiction problem. Yes, there are criminal consequences to that, but there also is an opportunity to provide treatment within that. Mm-hmm. Sheriff McKeithen started the Lifeline program when we took over the jail, which is a drug treatment program in jail, and we're continually working within that program and looking to expand that and be innovative in that to try to turn the tide.
How receptive are your clients? No, the inmates, how receptive are they to programs like that versus, again, this opinion question, mm-hmm. versus, well, I'm in here, this is better than sitting in a cell, I'll go to the class.
Well, there's varying degrees, but a lot of people want help. They want to be able to get off this substance, and mm-hmm. they can't because of the very strong, addiction properties that it has. When I look at the jail, it's a situation where they're in there, consequences to their actions that led them to jail, but we're paying for their room and board already and to the security of the facility. So using the program like the Lifeline and our mission-based resilience program to try to make a difference mm-hmm. on this issue. And my goal would be not to have repeat customers at the jail. Okay. We're battling with record high population numbers at the jail. Yep. And we have to do something to try to turn that around. I think we can leverage the fact that we're, they're in jail and provide treatment and innovative programs to try to make them successful when they're released.
Well, and for every person you have in jail on a charge like this, and for everybody, like the young man mm-hmm. this morning, there's a family attached to that person.
Absolutely.
We don't know the person this morning if they had children or not, but a lot of these addicts that you're dealing with, they do. They have families. They have children. There's a lot of victims of this epidemic outside of the people who are addicted mm-hmm. and overdosing. Children in particular, we've noticed some reports. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you had mentioned right before we went on the air, you had run across some. If you'd share that, what the question comes down to is, how does this affect the kids in our community mm-hmm. who are going to grow up and shape our county?
It's a devastating effect on family and kids, and that's why I think this is so critical that we address it as a community. You look at some of the statistics that don't bode well for us, the high removal rate of kids from drug situations, and it's something that we have to address for the person involved, but as well as their family, because it's got generational consequences. Mm-hmm. to it. These are the stories that I'm telling are not things that happened a year ago, or the story on the overdose, the 25-year-old last night. Yesterday we had a drug investigator that was on an undercover operation, sitting in a parking lot. A car pulls up next to him. A male and a female are in the car. They began injecting opiates. They're arrested, and there's a 6-month-old child in the back seat of the car, which DCF has now certainly come and take custody of that child. So just devastating generational.
And then that branches out into DCF is looking for foster parents, mm-hmm. which we don't have enough of, mm-hmm. and the child has moved around, and it mm-hmm. it's a very bad cycle.
Absolutely.
Do you think we've attacked things before in Bay County, but what do we have to do to be successful with this? What can be done, and what would you say to people? What can people do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got to be a community effort. I view at the sheriff's office, our relationship with the community is very important to us, because we can't do this job without the community's involvement, both from the support level, but also in working to provide resources for to try to stem the tide of this problem.
Is it y'all's main priority right now, outside of the job that the sheriff's office does, mm-hmm. And then you have your priorities list of things you want to deal with? Is that at the top right now?
It is. Okay. It is. Certainly there's multiple priorities, School safety is something that is a high priority for us and the school district and this community. So.
Did you have any questions, Katie?
One of the questions we got from Margaret Lamb is she wants to know what changes you've made at the department to make sure that you are addressing the issue. Mm-hmm. I know you've added Narcan. Mm-hmm. You've made some changes to mm-hmm. how you're running the jail. Mm-hmm. Is there any other changes mm-hmm. that you've made to address?
Well, the first thing is continuing our prioritization of enforcement efforts. We also were one of the first agencies in the area to introduce Narcan. We kept going to overdose after overdose. EMS has been carrying Narcan since the 80s. They would go to situations, our deputies would go to situations followed by EMS where people were, you know, two or three respirations a minute for all practical purposes. They were an overdose death. EMS would get there and administer Narcan, and in many cases that they would recover very quickly from that. So I just felt a need that, you know, that if you're breathing two or three times a minute, you know, minutes save lives. And we're in the life-saving business. So the faster we could get to them, if we could get there 2 minutes ahead of EMS, and if we were the ones that able to administer Narcan, you know, then that would potentially be a life-saving effort. The other things that we focused on is some of the programs in the jail. Again, we've had the Lifeline program. We've been working to expand that. There are a couple of other programs within that I'm proud of and that I'm hoping will make a difference. We saw people that would come into the jail addicted to opiates. They would detox off the opiates. They may even be in some of our treatment programs. Sometimes the court would order them to begin medication-assisted treatment when they left jail. They would go be referred to outpatient counseling, or they'd be referred to begin treatment with Suboxone or some other substances, and a fairly new substance that I learned about, the Vivitrol, which is a 30-day acting injection that blocks the opioid receptors. We had a couple of cases that really touched me that had a couple of ladies that were released from jail. They went back into the same environment they were in where the triggers for addiction began using again, believing they could use the same dosage level as they did before they detoxed, which that's an issue when people get out and their tolerance levels are lower. It's much more hazardous for an overdose at that time. And they died within several days of being released from jail. So we worked with Big Bend Community-Based Care, Gulf Coast Addiction Medicine, and now Life Management. So we were able to bring the Vivitrol program from an outpatient setting, start it in the jail setting before they were released. So before they get out, they're given this injection, which blocks their opioid receptors for 30 days. And in my mind, gives them a fighting chance to get to that next appointment. And there's been, you know, it's a kind of a new program. I think we're one of eight jails in the state that are now doing that. But there's some good early statistics that prior to us bringing that into the jail, there was about a 40-50% show rate of people that were released who would show up and begin the Vivitrol treatment and outpatient counseling. Now we've got that up to about 70%. So it's important to have these programs in the jail, but it's also equally as important for them to continue the outpatient treatment and in the cases where it's warranted, the medication-assisted treatment. We also have the mission-based resilience program mm-hmm. that we started at the jail that I'm really excited about. It's a program developed by Dr. Ed Najjar. He's a retired Navy SEAL commander. He's got his PhD in organizational psychology. Developed this program that focuses on physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual resilience. Developed it for military, law enforcement, and corporate clients. We instituted that at the sheriff's office and had our command staff and a lot of the deputies went through this program with Ed to develop resilience so we could face the stresses of our job.
Was that physical thing you tried to con me into before I hurt my hip a few years ago?
Yeah, okay. He mysteriously came up with this hip injury which couldn't do it all of a sudden. So. But yeah, so, you know, as we were looking at programs that we could institute in the Lifeline program, it just kind of dawned on us that program could be effective. in this in the setting of a drug rehabilitation, teaching people that were addicted to these substances, you know, resilience, how to handle the stresses of life rather than turning to an opiate, and have turned to these tools that they're given in this mission-based resilience class. We're fixing to start our fourth class, and just it's very touching to hear some of the individuals that are involved in that and what it's meant to them to go through this program successfully completed. It's not easy. I mean, Dr. Najjar is a Navy SEAL.
Oh, I saw what y'all are doing. It was There's a reason I decided I had a hip injury.
If you didn't have one before, you
know.
Yeah, very intense physical, but it's so much more than that. It's, you know, in focusing on each of those areas of your life, it has you develop goals and a plan to meet those goals, and then some accountability measures. He teaches a process called cognitive restructuring that, you know, I use it to this day, and that if you're faced with any problem, look at it from another perspective. And he has worksheets that you go through where you look at that problem from another perspective and actually prove the other perspective. And he causes you to look at things, you know, from a different perspective, develop empathy, and just gives you tools to use to cope with those, you know, the stresses of life.
Yeah, and speaking along the lines of empathy and perspective, you know, I think one thing want to make sure doesn't get lost in here, when we read about somebody being arrested or in jail, or this young man who overdosed this morning, you know, even in my brain, the immediate reaction is an addict, a drug user overdosed. Mm-hmm. And what the people who become addicted, it's not all people who started, you know, their teenage years off abusing drugs and alcohol, mm-hmm. and graduated from one drug to another and ended up with the painkillers. Y'all also see, I know there's not a percentage, but mm-hmm. how often or how unusual is it that the addiction started with an injury and a prescription to painkillers?
Yeah, that's really the insidious nature of this addiction. This is not, you know, can it start by somebody, you know, looking for a high, and, you know, yes, it can. But a lot of the times it starts with somebody with, you know, surgery, you know, shoulder surgery, knee surgery, injured in a car accident, hurt their back at work. Starts by valid prescriptions in that manner, which, you know, I don't want to take away from the fact that it from the side of some of the prescription pain medicine, mm-hmm. that they're effective in treating pain, and that doctors, you know, for the most part do a very good job of regulating that and effectively treating pain with them. But you can get addicted with deadly consequences, and you know, we see that quite a bit, where somebody didn't start out wanting to get high or use a drug, started treating pain and became addicted, which can, you know, that leads to heroin, fentanyl use, and things like that.
We have a question about how the opioid epidemic compares to meth, because we see a lot of that in the police reports, mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And even in the stories we did this weekend, there was a lot of people who talked about having an opioid problem but also having a meth problem at the same time. So how do those compare to you guys?
And make no mistake, we still have an issue with meth there, and it's something that we work very hard to fight, you know, as far as priorities, right up there with the opiate issue. And we do see co-occurring situations where people are using both. Meth is extremely addictive. It's destructive to families and of the community as well. We really, one of the differences is we don't see the overdose deaths, but it certainly destroys lives.
We also saw a lot of Xanax in the reports from these.
Yeah, that surprised me. Xanax and Valium overdoses, which we as a news organization don't generally hear about, right. That was way high.
They can be abused, and what we typically see with that is what we call polydrug overdoses, where there are multiple drugs involved in an overdose. In other words, the hydrocodone and Xanax, or
drinking or heroin with Xanax, Valium, or mixing alcohol with some of those drugs. Mm-hmm.
And then we had another question about, you know, Bay County has the second highest rate of prescriptions in the state, and we also have really high child removal rates. And there's a question of if the laws on the books are working, if you feel like you have enough tools on the legal side of things to help control the prescriptions, or to either keep children in their homes or take them out of their homes, mm-hmm. depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm. I think we do that. You know, it was there's been at the national and the state level a focus on this issue from the law enforcement side of it, as well as the treatment treatment side of it, and some funding that's being pushed out for that. Also, I think the governor signed this into law already, but there was a law that was being proposed that would limit some of the length of time of the prescription of the opiates. In other words, instead of going to, you know, not most doctors, I think, were probably already following this, but instead of getting a 30-day supply when you have a surgery or a tooth, whatever pain issue may be, limiting the number of days of supply, I think that has the potential to help on the end of somebody getting surgery and then getting addicted, because it is shortening that supply.
And how about on the children's side of things? Would the statutes that dictate whether or not a child's removed from the home, do you think those are working?
Well, again, it's very sad situations, where we see these drugs that are destroying family and affecting kids. That's going to, affect future generations. We work closely with the Department of Children and Family. We work very closely with the Gulf Coast Children's Advocacy Center on these type of cases.
And we will have a story this Sunday that's focusing on that, mm-hmm. That Katie's involved in and taking a look at that. So we hope people will take a look at Sunday's paper. Mm-hmm.
Did you have anything, Katie?
I have a friend who he likes to say, he had a problem and we want fast solutions. Mm-hmm. And people I've worked with who've faced addiction, they decide they want to get out of it, but they want it to happen overnight and they want it to stop. And my friend would say, it took me 5 years to walk into the woods. Mm-hmm. It's going to take me, I can't walk out in a day. Mm-hmm. This is, I'm guessing, a process. This is not, you can't fix anything overnight, but what are your expectations for these things? I'm not going to say starting to make a change, because they may already, probably they are already starting to make a change because the community's involved, but mm-hmm. How long of a process is something like this to make a difference?
Very, very challenging. The rehabilitation of these substances is very challenging. One of the very difficult to accomplish on an outpatient basis. And again, this is one of those where we talked earlier, in my opinion, I'm not a licensed substance abuse counselor, mm-hmm. I'm a cop, but some of these, that's why I think leveraging the resources at the jail where we already have their room and board is, they're sentenced to be there, mm-hmm. And we can leverage that resources inpatient treatment. But it's gonna require a multifaceted approach. One, keeping up our efforts on enforcement and getting this out of the street, off the streets, utilizing the jail and our rehabilitation programs there, being innovative about that. If something makes sense, we're going to do it. I kind of learned that from Sheriff McKeithen, as sheriff, with the resources we have and the authority that we have, that if there's something that makes good common sense, that we can try it,
And I believe y'all, for instance, have, in addition to these things that you've generated or y'all have generated, you allow outside groups to mm-hmm. that deal with addicts and alcoholics to come in and have meetings, and mm-hmm. you make those resources available to the people who
Absolutely.
Want them as well.
And it's going to take the community efforts like the volunteering and programs at the jail, as well as outpatient treatment services.
It's a long
children. Additional, focusing on services from children, say from the Gulf Coast Children's Advocacy Center and things like that, to kind of help make sure that this doesn't carry over from generation to generation.
Good deal. Well, we're going to continue to focus on this, like the Sheriff's Office, so you'll be seeing a lot about this year in the News Herald. We'll keep up with what y'all are doing. We're going to throw in a couple of shameless plugs here. I've already thrown one in. But do check out Sunday's paper if this is a topic of interest to you, because we will be taking a look this Sunday at how this is affecting children in Bay County. And I want to give the sheriff a chance. Before we came in here, there's a raging wildfire over in Gulf County. It's about 6,500 acres now, and we were talking in the newsroom. We've had quite a few fires locally, unrelated, that were house fires. Mm-hmm. But one of your deputies lost everything mm-hmm. to a fire, yeah. and there's a fundraiser that I believe starts today.
Yeah, Doug Diekman was one of our maintenance people out at the jail, and a couple of weeks ago in Lynn Haven, his house burned and they lost everything. So at the sheriff's office, we, you know, are like a family. So we've come together to try to help him, and excited for these next 2 days. Today and tomorrow, we're doing a food truck fair. We've got two food trucks there today, two tomorrow. I think 11 to 1.
Okay. And do you know where, off the top of your head, do you know where? We had it in the paper today on Front Local, but I don't remember the address either.
It's in front of the sheriff's office, 3421 Highway 77. Okay. We've got, I think, the prime rib guy in Temperley's today, and we've got back Porch Barbecue and another there tomorrow. Going to be some good food. We've got a silent auctions, and of course, we'll be accepting donations for Mr. Diekman. We've had some people just really have come forward to help with that too. Mr. Alan Bentz contacted us and offered to match donations, you know, up to $5,000 on that. We've had Jerry Wilson has come forward to make some donations as well, and just numerous businesses that have contributed to the silent auction. And so we're just so grateful.
You know, it's like, to me, maybe we can close with this. It is like the opioid. I'm going to learn that word. Epidemic. It can't be solved by government alone mm-hmm. any more than this your employees right. problem can. It can be right. solved by the community coming working together. Together with what government has to offer
Absolutely.
Together to fix the problem.
And that's
what without that tandem.
You're right. And that's what's so great about Bay County. They always come together no matter what the issue is. And it's a great community.
All right, Sheriff, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.